May it please the Court, Benno Weisberg, I represent the appellant James Winbush. Your Honors, we stand on the arguments in our briefs, but would like to focus today on two issues, a primary issue and a secondary issue. Primarily, we challenge the denial of Winbush's request for funding for a fingerprint expert brought under the Criminal Justice Act. And the secondary issue we'll address concerns the improper and prejudicial testimony presented at trial of an FBI agent who testified as an expert about various aspects of the illegal drug industry, entirely unrelated to the facts of the case, and which had nothing to do with Winbush's case and which prejudiced his conviction on two counts. Turning to the first issue, prior to trial, Winbush brought a motion for funding for a fingerprint expert under the Criminal Justice Act, which...
How long prior to trial?
5 days, Your Honor.
After how many continuances?
I believe there were four or five continuances over 2 years, Your Honor. However, Mr. Winbush had only been put on notice of his need for an expert shortly before bringing the motion, and I'll get to that issue shortly. The fingerprint-related evidence in this case related entirely to Winbush's possession of two packages of crack cocaine that were found in the snow following his arrest and near the scene of his arrest, as well as the gun found by the Gary, Indiana police, also in the snow following Winbush's arrest. And this evidence...
But could I get back in a way to the point that Judge Kaney was just alluding to? The government tells Mr. Winbush in a notice filed October 3, 2007, that it's going to introduce expert testimony from two witnesses about fingerprints. And actually, Mr. Winbush stipulates as to one of those witnesses. And it's not until more than a month after that that Mr. Winbush comes forward with his request for an expert. So even if you look over any earlier time, there's a lot of time, actually. And I guess I can't understand if the real point that Mr. Winbush is trying to make is that there are two possible explanations for the lack of recovered fingerprints on these materials. One of them is that they just didn't take, you know, because of the cold or because of the nature of the materials. The other is because he never touched it. You know, I assume that's what he would want to say. I don't know why he can't bring that out during cross-examination of the government witness that did testify.
Well, Your Honor, the government actually presented two expert witnesses on the fingerprint issue.
But I thought one of them that was stipulated that...
That's correct. That witness presented entirely exculpatory evidence that
Mr.
was
Mr. Winbush, a stipulation means both sides agree it can come in that way. So isn't that a full-out waiver of Mr. Winbush's right to complain about that first one?
No, Your Honor, because Mr. Winbush's motion was brought for funding for a rebuttal expert as to the second witness.
I'm asking for the second witness who actually testified, why can't Mr. Winbush say, wouldn't you agree that another reason why there are no fingerprints on these things is because he never touched it? I would think any common sense person would say, well, yeah, that's one reason why there might not be fingerprints.
You're correct, Your Honor, but Michael Riley, that second expert who was from the Lake County, Indiana Crime Lab, he testified about the meaning of the evidence, and he provided several scientific bases for his conclusion that Mr. Winbush could have indeed touched these items and without leaving fingerprints.
I understand that perfectly, but what I don't understand is why in an adverse witness cross-examination context somebody couldn't say, isn't it true that another reason that there's no fingerprint on it is because he never touched it?
Under certain circumstances, I agree that cross-examination would suffice, but under these circumstances, Mr. Winbush had a court-appointed counsel, and what he asked for really was an expert to assist him in addition to providing rebuttal testimony that would provide an alternative explanation. What he wanted was someone to assist him with cross-examination and to provide scientific bases for such an alternative basis.
Well, but there is no fingerprints on the weapon and the contraband.
That's correct, and that evidence actually favored Winbush and was voluntarily presented at trial by the government, who then presented a second expert who testified about the meaning of that absence of fingerprints and testified, in essence, that it was meaningless.
It could have not had any fingerprints because it was cold and whatever. But as Judge Wood pointed out, the other side of that is easily he didn't touch it.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think under these circumstances, however, where the government affirmatively offered the testimony of Riley to excuse the lack of fingerprint evidence presented by the other witness, Michael Shea, who testified by stipulation that no prints of value were found on the
right. And, of course, the government's been very worried by what it calls the CSI effect or whatever. The juries are going to think, no fingerprints, therefore innocent. And I think it's trying to put that scientific evidence in some kind of context for the jury. But I wanted to go back, too, to the first point that Judge Kaney made. You seem to argue that Section 3006, capital AE, is something that can be raised at any time, and it's somehow exempt from the trial court's ordinary ability to manage the trial, time limits and schedules. And I don't see a word in that section that says, you know, this can be raised at any time up to the end of the trial.
That's correct. Neither is there a word saying that it must be brought by a certain time.
That's correct, but I guess in that instance, since there isn't anything, I don't know why we wouldn't fall back to the default rule that trial judges can manage the processing of a case.
Well, that's true, and Rule 12 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure provides that the trial court can indeed set a pretrial motion schedule.
Sure.
But that rule also enumerates several motions, not including motions brought for funding for an indigent defendant for expert services that must be brought prior to trial. And therefore, that a motion brought under the Criminal Justice Act does not fall under the ambit of that rule. And therefore, if the district court sets a pretrial motion schedule, that should not preclude a defendant from bringing a motion for funding for an expert if he's only put on notice for that expert shortly before bringing the motion, and that was the case with Mr. Windisch.
How did this notice change what his defense might be?
Well, Your Honor, the actual notice of expert witnesses submitted by the government stated only that, first of all, Michael Shea, the first expert who ended up testifying by stipulation, was going to testify as to the results of his fingerprint analysis. It did not state what the results of that fingerprint analysis was, and that the second expert, Michael Riley, was going to testify about the difficulties in obtaining fingerprint evidence under certain circumstances.
Well, then you knew from the beginning that there were no fingerprints on the...
It's not clear from the record, Your Honor, when that became apparent to Mr. Windisch. It's
but
certainly
it's a
not clear
stipulation.
From the...
I mean, are you saying that Mr. Windisch stipulated to a black box? I mean, did he stipulated to Mr. Shea's testimony without knowing what it was going to be?
No. The stipulation was entered after Mr. Windisch filed his motion for a fingerprint expert. And by the government's own account and its response brief, the parties were still discussing essentially what the fingerprint evidence was going to be in this case as of November 2nd, the final pretrial conference. And Mr. Windisch brought his motion very shortly thereafter.
But on October 3rd, there was notice of expert witnesses given.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the notice of expert witnesses was vague. And, in fact, considering the many pieces of evidence that were at issue in this case, some of which had to do with the evidence tested by Mr. Shea, it was not clear from that notice what Riley was going to testify to.
Shea would testify that no latent prints of value were found on the items tested?
That's right. That was not clear from the notice. It said that Michael Shea was going to testify about the evidence
He would testify about the difficulties in obtaining latent fingerprints from different materials and surfaces.
Right, that was Riley's testimony, but
you knew about that, or your client's team knew about that. I mean, why would Riley be about to testify, quote, about the difficulties in obtaining latent fingerprints if, in fact, Shea was going to come in and say, yeah, but we were lucky, we found a great set? You know, I just...
Well, there's two issues
there.
At
least a hint.
it's not clear from the record that Shea's analysis was complete, nor that Winbush knew what the results of that analysis was. It's certainly not clear from the notice of expert witnesses. And, Your Honor, why would the government bring this testimony in voluntarily that no fingerprints were found had it known as of October 3rd, which is 1 month before Winbush brought his motion, that there were no finger latent prints of value?
Because they're afraid juries are going to misinterpret that. I mean, I think that's a real concern.
But they were under no obligation to bring that testimony in the first place. If they knew what the evidence was as of October 3rd, why would they not just leave that evidence out, the fact that no fingerprints were found? They chose to present that testimony, and they chose to present
a
second
expert.
Well,
that could be considered exculpatory, I suppose, in one way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if they've run the test, exactly, yeah.
It is exculpatory, but they're not required to introduce that evidence at trial.
They're required to disclose it to Mr. Winbush if it's exculpatory.
That's correct, but they're not required to present witness testimony at trial regarding the analysis of the evidence.
But I want to go back to the standard of review. I'm perfectly prepared to believe that if somebody makes a motion under 3006A 5 days before the trial, it would be within the discretion of a district court judge to grant that motion. But I equally think it's within the discretion of a district court judge to say this is too late, and surely our standard of review here is abuse of discretion.
That's correct, Your Honor. It is an abuse of discretion standard, and the trial court abuses discretion in a number of ways. First, in denying the motion in the first instance, the motion should have been granted given the other evidence at issue in this case. And secondly, the district court denied the motion without providing an ex parte proceeding, which is required under the Act.
Where do you see that the judge is all? I mean, that's a rare rule. If the judge doesn't think there's anything that needs resolving in some kind of hearing outside the jury, you know, I'm not quite sure what you mean by ex parte proceeding anyway.
The Criminal Justice Act provides that upon finding after appropriate inquiry in an ex parte proceeding that services are necessary, the judge shall authorize counsel to obtain services. It's right there in the statute.
Right, but I guess if the judge has said, you know, you had your chance to do this and you passed it up, surely there's a time, you'd have to agree that there's a time that it's too late. You can't come in the day before closing arguments and say, oops, you know, we want an expert witness.
I do agree that there's a time, and I believe the time can only be taken to be the time in which the defendant is put on notice that he's going to require these services.
Well, if you had, we'll get back to the very initial inquiry Judge Wood made, there were no fingerprints. And this, if there were fingerprints on there and there was some dispute about how they would apply, then maybe you might have some argument. But here there were none.
That's correct. And again, Mr. Winbush stipulated that.
Just stand up and say, well, Mr. Expert, why wouldn't there be fingerprints on that again? Well, because he didn't touch it. What else are you going to get from him?
Well, Riley testified about various reasons why there wouldn't be fingerprints, and that's what Winbush was challenging. He wanted a scientific expert to get up there and say,
I think Mr. Winbush was pushing your counsel, as he had prior to those times, to get those continuances.
Well, the continuance really would not have prejudiced the government. In fact, Winbush was in jail awaiting trial. He wasn't a flight risk. He wasn't going anywhere. And meanwhile, the government, the witnesses that were presented by the government were all in-state witnesses, with one exception who was coming from Chicago. The trial took place in Hammond, Indiana.
That's
so there's no prejudice.
Out of state, as a matter of fact.
There's no prejudice to the government here. And there's certainly no benefit for Winbush. He's awaiting trial in jail. He's not going anywhere. He wasn't out on bond. So in conclusion, the district court should have granted Winbush's motion and abused his discretion in denying it as untimely without an ex parte proceeding as is required under the Criminal Justice Act.
Thank you, Mr. Weinberg. You do have some time for rebuttal yet.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Chang.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Jennifer Chang-Indiga on behalf of the United States. The appellant in this case, James Winbush, does bring three main arguments here on appeal. I will first address the first argument that the appellant addressed here at oral argument today, and that is that the district court erred by denying his motion for a fingerprint expert under 3006AE. Now, as the court correctly pointed out, what the district court did in this case was denied that motion on the basis of its untimeliness. He claims, or the appellant claims, that the motion was filed 5 days before trial. The record is clear. It was filed on a Thursday. Trial was set for Tuesday. Monday was a federal holiday.
Ms. Chang, how early, or do you prefer to be called Chang Adiga?
Either way is fine, Your Honor.
Okay. At what time did the government notify the defense that fingerprint tests had been run and it had turned out that no prints could be found?
Your Honor, I don't have the exact date, but Shea's analysis and the results of that analysis were timely tendered in discovery. There was no discovery violation in this case, and the analysis and the result that there were no prints of value detected on any of the drug packaging or the gun in this case was timely tendered to defense counsel.
So, but when you say timely, that means more than 5 days before the trial? I mean, his
absolutely,
claim
yes.
is notice here, and if you would... Would the record show that? Or was there a discovery schedule? Or
Your Honor, yes. There was a discovery schedule set out in the arraignment order, and it was just like any other discovery schedule that the magistrate court orders.
Did you have, in your brief, you said notice of expert witnesses was made on October 3, 2007. Did the results of their or summary of their testimony appear with that?
In the notice of expert witnesses, the government laid out that Shea would specifically testify consistent with the lab reports that had been tendered to defense counsel in the case. Prior to October 3rd, when the notice of expert witnesses was filed with the court, the defense, Winbush's attorneys, did have the results of Shea's analysis. That showed that there were no latent prints of value detected on the items submitted for analysis. Furthermore, the government's notice stated also, I think as the court pointed out earlier, that Riley would testify regarding the difficulty of obtaining prints off of certain surfaces.
That was on that October 3rd.
That's correct, Your Honor. Another point I'd like to bring out is the court mentioned is that the appellant has no basis to claim surprise in this case or lack of notice as to the fact, as he seems to assert in his brief, that he was surprised that he would not have the opportunity to cross-examine Shea at trial. And as the court correctly pointed out, that stipulation as to Shea's testimony could not have been entered into but for Winbush agreeing that, yes, I agree to this stipulation. And so, therefore, that argument lacks merit. And we know that at least at the pretrial conference on November 2nd, on that date, and it's in the minute entry in the record, that Winbush agreed to stipulate to Shea's testimony, and that agreement was verbally communicated to the magistrate judge at the time. And that's at least 2 weeks before trial. And I'd like to get back to the fact that the untimeliness was the basis of the court's denial of this motion. We know that the case had been pending since 2005 from the record. There had been a total of, I believe, 5 continuances granted, all requested by Winbush. While 3 of the continuances were granted to defense counsel, that was prior to Winbush's trial counsel, and then that counsel did withdraw from the case, and Winbush's trial counsel entered the case. At that point, a trial date was set. Winbush's counsel requested a continuance, was granted that continuance, requested a second continuance, was denied that continuance, but then the government did return, or the grand jury did return a second superseding indictment against Winbush, and Winbush did receive a continuance based on that. And so I believe, and I would submit, that the district court denying this motion, I believe they said in a case that's been pending for over 2 years, a motion filed a few days before trial is just woefully late. And it's clear that the district court has a wide discretion to maintain the efficiency of its calendar, and that's exactly what it was doing here.
What did the superseding indictment add?
Your Honor, the second superseding indictment added the count 2, I believe, which is possession with intent to distribute 5 grams or more of crack cocaine. Do the judges have any questions regarding the other arguments in the brief? If not, I will stand on my brief. Thank you very much. We would ask that you affirm the conviction and sentence of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Weisberg, how much time? I'll give him 2 minutes for if you want them.
I'll take them. Your Honor, counsel made several references to the record. In particular, she mentioned that the final pretrial minute entry indicated that the parties were stipulating to the to Shea's testimony. I don't believe that's correct. I don't have the minute entry in front of me, but I believe the minute entry simply stated that various dates were mentioned at the pretrial hearing. And in fact, the government's own brief states that at that pretrial hearing, the parties were still discussing Shea's testimony and whether it was going to be stipulated to. The other point I'd like to make is that the record here is not clear. And that's why there's an ex parte proceeding requirement in the Act. An indigent defendant in Winbush's position has to be able to present to the court his reasons why he needs the expert without prejudicing his case by doing it in front of the government. And he was denied the opportunity to do that when his motion was denied summarily as being untimely. He wasn't able to state for the court the timeline that is clearly relevant here as to when he received notice of his need for an expert. Without that opportunity, he was clearly prejudiced, and the trial court abused its discretion in not granting what was required under the Act, which is an ex parte hearing, and is required under this court's case law. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, and thank you, Counsel. You were appointed to this case to take this case. You have vigorously represented your client, and we appreciate that. We appreciate the work of both counsel. Case is taken under advisement.